Hi all, I'm Shel Beckwith, and this is number 0626, 40 away from the episode of The Beast, of the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. And it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0626. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, Amit Zappa, the host of a new show about collectibles called Rock My Collection.
Guests on the show showcasing items that are near and dear to their hearts, but just had this other level of personalization. It was less like, I got this clock. It was more like, I'm such a fan of this musician, I had to have this piece of memorabilia. I loved every conversation I had with all of these fans and these collectors. I even was reduced to tears. So it was a total joy working on Rock My Collection. If you're a music fan, if you're a collector of any kind of thing, I think you'll enjoy the show.
Diane Zinna, who is the author of the novel The All Night Sun. It's a story that takes you all the way to Sweden, and it's based partly on a true story from Diane's life.
When I was in my mid-20s, I was teaching at a small conservative college. I had just lost both of my parents, and I found myself in this city. Into my classroom, into my life, walked this international student, and I bonded over grief. And we formed this really deep friendship, and at the end of the semester, she asked me to go home with her to Sweden, to travel through the country, meet her family. You know, under any other circumstance, I probably would have said no, but her invitation was so vibrant.
Marty McGibbon is the author of Fierce, Funny, and Female. It's her second memoir talking about her rough and tumble times, like when she worked in the Texas oil fields.
Some of the stories in Fierce, Funny, and Female are just absolutely hilarious. This was the 1980s, the oil field, and it was like the Wild West. The guys who I worked with, they would go and rob a liquor store on their lunch hour. And some of the crew chiefs would even, you know, take their crew out and do a robbery and then do a hot, be in the police in hot pursuit, and there'd be a real big car chase. Things like that happen. I mean, not every day.
And we have lots and lots of Stuff File news and, of course, an idiot of the day. The guest later, the person who told you that this was show number 0626, was Shel Beckwith, a Stuff File listener and Patreon subscriber, and possibly a devil worshiper, who hails from Winnipeg, who likes to remind everyone that the Winnipeg Blue Bombers were Grey Cup champions for 2 years running. It's a COVID technicality, but hey. Sheldon, I believe there was only one Grey Cup parade around Portage in Maine, and it was in November of 2019. By the way, you know what's also in Winnipeg? CKUW 95.9 FM, where you can also hear the Stuff File program. Thank you very much, Shel, for doing the guest late on this edition of the Stuff File program, a show that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. And also, thank you very much to new Patreon patron, Allison Joy Coakley. It's truly a joy to have you aboard. Thank you, Joy, for being part of this show and helping us along. Let's get right to the stuff, shall we? Okay, this is a story that has two things that, frankly, I can do without. A 19-year-old woman in Kenosha, Wisconsin, accidentally shot a friend with his own handgun on August the 10th while using the weapon's laser sight to entertain a cat. The woman, who had been drinking, according to a witness, picked up the friend's handgun, turned on the laser sight, and was pointing it at the floor to get the cat to chase it. The gun went off, and a bullet struck the 22-year-old man in the thigh. The victim was charged with violating bond conditions that prevented him from having a gun. What, they're not charging the cat with anything? I mean, they are evil, you know. Little pieces of evil, plotting against mankind. Zi Yan of Singapore called animal welfare group Acres to her home on July 28th because of what she believed was a snake hissing in a cupboard near her bed. She sent a recording of the noise, and Acres concluded it was probably a black spitting cobra. The rescue team, armed with protective eyewear and snake grabbers, methodically searched her bedroom, but what they came up with was much less threatening. It was a malfunctioning Oral-B electric toothbrush buzzing away. Said the toothbrush owner, "The problem started because water got into my electrical toothbrush and affected the mechanism. I should really buy a new one. I don't want to go through this again." Well, perhaps you should go back to an original. You know, an acoustic toothbrush instead of an electric one. I have another snake story, but in this one, the bells signify the Darwin File.
I am the Grim Reaper. I am death.
65-year-old Rama Matto was reportedly drunk outside his home in the village of Madote, which is in India, on August the 8th, when a baby snake bit him on the leg. Contrary to common advice in the wake of a snake bite, Matto captured the little snake and started chewing on it in revenge, during which his family said he was bitten more than 10 times on the face. His family urged him to seek medical help at the hospital, but he went to bed and never woke up. Matto had told his family he didn't think the snake was venomous due to its age. Well, now he knows. Because the tree of life is often self-pruning.
I have come for you. I am death.
Okay, let's pause for a moment. I would like to pause for a moment here to share something from a religious wingnut. You may have heard of evangelical prophetess Kat Kerr of Jacksonville, Florida. She spews extremely right-wing political nonsense like an out-of-control bilge pump. I occasionally look at some of her YouTube shows as a gauge for the sliding scale of where insanity and reality might be. Now, I don't want to talk about her politics, which are frightening, because we don't generally talk about politics on this show, if we can help it. Although she does say that she may have gotten the COVID-19 vaccine if Trump were still president, but won't be taking it now because that villain Biden is in the White House, so she doesn't trust it. Please find the logic in that statement. Anyway, no, we're not talking about politics here. What I'd like to talk about is this evangelical's musings on religion. Actually, I'd like to let her talk about it. She's been to heaven, you know. So what better person is there to describe exactly what heaven is like?
There is rain in heaven. There is absolutely nothing destructive. There's no earthquakes. Now, there are volcanoes, but they're for entertainment. They're for fun. You get to ride the lava out.
Really?
Yeah, you get to ride out on the lava. It wouldn't cause us that. It's not a physical volcano you took from the earth and put it up there. It would still be. It's a spiritual world. The land, the air, everything there is spiritual, but it is. It has substance. It's a literal volcano, but it wouldn't harm you. And yes, people can go inside and they ride the lava out for a ride.
Talk about a hot seat.
Stupid! You're so stupid!
Really? You want to ride lava? Okay. Let's get to our first guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Access TV just launched a brand new music memorabilia series called Rock My Collection. It's hosted by Amit Zappa with co-host appraiser Stephen Braitman. The series showcases unique items such as Elvis's bank loans, a map of Italy signed by Jimi Hendrix, Tom Petty's scooter and Brian Wilson's driver's license, as well as pieces signed during each episode by iconic guests including Alice Cooper, Heart founder Nancy Wilson, Todd Rundgren, and more. Joining us to talk about the show is host Amit Zappa himself. He's on the line from Los Angeles. Hi, Amit.
Hey, how are you doing? Thanks for having me on your show.
Just tickety-boo. Thanks very much for being on the program with us. So this almost sounds like one of those PBS shows, only it's with rock memorabilia instead of old clocks.
Yeah, you know, as someone who likes, I think the show that you're referencing, you know, where people bring on, you know, some family heirloom, I always found that intriguing. And, you know, so when the opportunity to do this show appeared before my eyes, I really was not suspecting that it would be so emotional. And I think that, you know, I have a really strong relationship with music. I love music. I am a collector of many things, music-related memorabilia, and it's deeply personal, right? I think music is a personal experience. So when we have guests on the show showcasing items that are near and dear to their hearts, I don't know. It just had this other level of personalization. I mean, it was less like, oh, I got this clock. It was more like, I'm such a fan of this musician, I had to have this piece of memorabilia. And I don't know, it just became this wonderful, you know, I loved every conversation I had with all of these fans and these collectors. And, you know, at one point, I even was reduced to tears. So it was a total joy working on Rock My Collection. I really think people, you know, if you're a music fan, if you're a collector of any kind of thing, I think you'll enjoy the show.
Well, for those who might not be aware, you know, the one or two who aren't, you are the administrator, the trustee of your dad's estate, Frank Zappa. Mm-hmm. And so you're familiar with memorabilia literally from the inside. And I'm just curious to know, because I'm sure you're very protective of everything that your dad did and how he's perceived through memorabilia. And as you know, there are some people out there who can be, for lack of a better term, somewhat charlatan-like, who will sell and get rid of things that the person whose memorabilia they're selling, they're not crazy about. So do you feel sort of like a keeper of the flame to make sure that this thing is all, for lack of a better term, legit and on the up and up?
Yeah, no, we take great care in authenticating or helping people that come on the show, authenticate their memorabilia. For instance, you know, we work with signature specialists. You know, if someone shows an album that's been autographed, you're like, how much was this piece of vinyl worth? You know, with these signatures, first we have to make sure that the signatures are real. And in some cases, we have to be the bearer of bad news for some of our guests and say, this is, you know, total forgery. Sorry, you were snookered and, you know, someone took advantage of you. Other cases, you know, people come on and they're like, we have no idea if this is real. Can you validate that for us? And we get to give them good news that, yes, indeed, you know, this is legit. And, you know, congratulations, it's worth X, Y, or Z. So I do have an inside perspective. Certainly the position that I have is, you know, working with my father's legacy, our family business. So, yeah, I think I know a thing or two about what a forgery looks like or how people take advantage of others because I see it on a regular basis. So, you know, again, another reason why it was fun to be able to impart some kind of hopeful, useful information to people who are just starting out their collections or, you know, need some advice on how to get something authenticated to establish provenance.
There is the bust or boom situation with what people bring to you, but are there any items in the middle? And by that I mean, let's just say for argument's sake, you have an album that is autographed by said artist, and therefore it's sentimental to have that autographed album, but it's not really worth much. Do you find there are items like that?
Sure. I mean, you know, I think that that's beauty is in the eye of the beholder, right? And that emotional connection. That's why I really enjoy doing the show. To your point, I think that it doesn't have to be something of immense financial value, but knowing that the signature is real, validating that is of immense emotional value to that collector. And I think that that's, you know, the beauty of the show. I am someone who is moved by, oh, that artist used that. That's awesome. I can't believe I'm now seeing it or touching it. So like the appeal to me to do the show and to meet other enthusiasts, was rather delicious.
One of the unique points about this show, as I mentioned in the introduction, is you also get current rock stars to come on the show and offer something up. How did that aspect of the show take place?
I wish I could say I came up with that segment, but it was far greater minds than mine. You know, there's an incredible team, Access TV. They are, you know, great to work with, critical content, other producers on the show, awesome support system. And Greg Johnston, the producer of the show, I want to say it was, it was his idea, and it turned out to be some of the most fun segments that we did because, we're in the middle of a pandemic, if you didn't know. And so normally we would probably have a much larger set and more people spending time with us inside. But because that became too onerous for our little show, you know, people would join us through the power of the internet. And it actually added a lot more value to the show in the sense that we were in these artists' personal spaces. So we got to see a little bit more of their universe, and they would kindly share with us memorabilia from their own collection, music memorabilia that is important to them. And then this silly little segment turned into quite a fun situation. We thought, well, wouldn't it be great if we could brainwash them into signing a piece of, I don't know, a toothbrush, a spork, or something silly that, you know, wouldn't be too challenging for the musician, and hopefully get them to play ball. Like something that was easy, just sign it and we'll auction it off for charity, right? Have some fun with us. But then, you know, in the case of a lot of our guests, you know, Nancy Wilson, Alice Cooper, artists that you mentioned, they were overly generous and truly gave, amazing things that we auctioned off for charity where they signed it. And, you know, I think there's an opportunity for people that are just wanting to become music memorabilia collectors or existing collectors. They'll actually want it, you know. So everyone is a really good sport. They were awesome to interview. So I had a great time. Well, and I think people will laugh. The show is also pretty funny, I think.
Excellent. Well, let me ask you this question, and it's a two-prong question, two answers, basically. When it comes to, as someone who's a collector yourself, when it comes to the holy grail of items that you either own or wished you'd own, what are the two items? And when I say two, one is an item from your dad, and one is an item from someone other than your dad. Go.
I have, it's a personal item for me. You know, I have a Rolls Royce that was our family car, and I think I was brought home from the hospital in this thing, and I ate the dashboard. I mean, this is before there were better safety features or safety laws, but. You know, when I'd be driven around as a kid, I'd sit on someone's lap in the front seat, and I would be teething on the leather on the front of the car. So, you know, there's this whole history. It still smells like, you know, my dad was a smoker. My mother, used to smoke back then when they were both alive. But you know, so like there's memories associated with this, you know, not to say that it's a Rolls Royce, it's a clunker, but I mean, it's to me, it has more sentimental value than probably the value of, you know, even if I say Rolls Royce, you know, you could pick up one of these cars for probably $12,000. You know, it's not some million-dollar car, but to me, it's worth billions.
Right. And the item that you covet or want that is not from your dad?
Oh, I mean, I'd love pretty much anything from Freddie Mercury. You know, a microphone would be amazing. one of his gesture-like outfits to me would be awesome to have. Because, you know, to me, he's a big inspiration. But I don't think I'm ever going to have that opportunity, nor do I think I could afford something along those lines.
Well, you know, you keep putting it out there and you have it and you mentioned it on the show one or two times. It might just come your way.
Fingers crossed, bro. I mean, anyone out there that has some authentic Freddie Mercury memorabilia that you want to give me, I'm into it.
Well, Amit, thank you very much for being on the program with us. The show, again, is Rock My Collection on Access TV. It's a pleasure to have you on the program with us.
Thank you for spending some time with me. Blessings to everybody. Be safe. Don't be COVID-iots. And be kind to one another.
Amit Zappa, the host of Rock My Collection on Access TV. The show just premiered. It airs on Sundays at 8 p.m. Eastern. Check your local listings for where you can find Access TV. You're listening to the Stump File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, a program that's heard everywhere, including KDXradio.com.
The Stump File program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Sign up and find out about our rewards program. Being a patron doesn't have to be a long-term commitment. There's absolutely no obligation. You could join today and end whenever you'd like, but the time we have your support would be so greatly appreciated. We'd also love to hear your thoughts about the show and even your ideas for rewards. Join us for the ride. Join us at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. This is your safe haven from the hard news of the day. The Stump File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's radio for your happy place.
And still to come on the program, you'll meet the author of The All Night Sun. Plus, Marty McGibbon is back on the program. She has her second memoir out. This one is called Fierce, Funny, and Female. We also have an Idiot of the Day coming your way and much more Stump File news here on the Stump File program, which is also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, The Smarter Way to listen to radio. A resident called police in Girard, Ohio around 3:30 a.m. on August the 5th to report that someone was banging on his front door with a stick. When officers arrived, they found damage to a window, but no one at the front door. Instead, 30-year-old Shamia Fudge was sleeping on the doghouse in the backyard. Officers reported that they could smell alcohol on Fudge, who told them the caller had slipped something into her drink. But one of the officers remembered seeing her outside a bar in Girard about an hour before. While being arrested for causing a disturbance, Fudge yelled at officers and hit one of them in the groin. She was also charged with resisting arrest. Well, I guess she's going from on the doghouse to into the doghouse now. Okay, here's a quote from 36-year-old Bronson Deagle, who was on Grand Bend South Beach in Ontario. To see four people all going under at the same time was all very shocking. A young girl in the water waving her arms in distress caught his attention, and as he ran to rescue her, he realized a young boy, a man, and a woman were all drowning simultaneously. Deagle is in training as a firefighter in London, Ontario, and managed to rescue all four, aided at the end by a man on a jet ski who rowed over to help. The woman was floating face down in the water, and all were fully dressed, and all four survived. Said the drowning man, who asked not to be identified, "I and my sister had surrendered to the waves and had lost hope of coming out alive. Bronson saw us and helped us. We cannot thank him enough for what he did. Okay, what I want to know is why are four fully clad people in the water with no explanation? And multiple people drowning at the same time reminds me of a question I've always had. I just finished watching the Tokyo Olympics, which I enjoyed, but I've always wondered, if a synchronized swimmer drowns, do they all have to drown? And speaking of the Olympics, North Korea is typically behind schedule when airing Olympic events, but this year is worse than usual. On August the 10th, Korean Central Television aired 70 minutes of a women's soccer match that had taken place weeks earlier on July 21st. The match was shown without commentary and in low resolution, begging the question of the source of the video. This year, North Korea declined to send a delegation to the Olympics for fear of COVID outbreaks. Pyongyang reports it has no cases of the virus, but experts are skeptical. Sadly, North Koreans may not even know who won the match, since 20 minutes were missing. I bet they never found out who shot JR either, or who Rosebud really is. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Diane Zinna is the author of The All Night Sun, which has been described as an unexpected love story. The first-time novelist joins us on the line from her home in Fairfax, Virginia. Hi, Diane.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
Thanks for being on the program with us. Now, as I mentioned, this is your first time as a novelist. They always say, write what you know. This story takes place in Sweden. What do you know about Sweden?
Oh, that's a great question. So when I was in my mid-20s, I was living in Washington, D.C., teaching at a small conservative college. I had just lost both of my parents, and I found myself in this city that was strange to me, completely on my own. And into my classroom, into my life, walked this international student, and she and I bonded over grief, you know, in the margins of her paper. And we formed this really deep friendship. And at the end of the semester, she asked me to go home with her to Sweden, to travel through the country, meet her family. You know, under any other circumstance, I probably would have said no, but her invitation was so vibrant. She said, everything will be green and fresh and new, just thawing out. It was going to be midsummer, and it felt to me like an invitation out of my grief. And so I went, and that's the beginning of this book.
So this has roots in real life. So when you decided to write this book, did you get in contact with this person? Is she aware of the fact that this book now exists?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I actually went back for her wedding many years later in Sweden. You know, when I went over there, it was a perfect trip. You know, it was really just a beautiful, idyllic time. And when I came home, I started thinking to myself, what if the bubble had burst? What if things had not gone right? You know, what if I had lost my job at the college, you know, for befriending a student, right? And I thought, you know, being so fragile as I was at that point in my life, what would I have had to learn or go through to make it out on the other end okay? And so, you know, from that very beginning, that feels like me in this novel, I took it to that point, you know, what if everything had gone wrong? And so that's what the novel turns out to be. And my friend is very happy to read it and recognize that that part is total fiction.
Well, I was about to ask that because was there any trepidation on your part in writing a fictionalized version of the relationship you had with this friend of yours in Sweden when, again, to fictionalize something like that, you've got to make someone the antagonist to your protagonist. You've got to, you know, it's not a memoir. Obviously, it's a novel.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Were you worried about that aspect of it? Were you worried about that aspect of her reading through this and reading the fictionalized version of the relationship you had?
I was. I mean, I was. I had to make her a character. Is what I had to do, right? You know, and there are antagonistic elements to the character on the page that don't exist in that friendship. But what I wanted her to love the book for the way that they come through it at the end, for the way that friendship really was transformational for that woman in grief. And that part is true. In fact, I was just talking to her about half an hour ago and telling her I was about to do this interview. And she asked me on that text today, she's like, I hope that we can go back there again someday together. And I burst out into tears because it was such a transformational time for me. And I'm just so honored that she can recognize that too.
When was the time frame that you actually traveled to Sweden initially and lived part of this story, as opposed to when you decided you were going to write this story? Was there a lag time between the two?
There was. There was a little bit of a lag time. So I was over there in 2000, 2001, thereabouts. And then, you know, a few years later, I woke up having had a dream. I had dreamt a book that had never happened to me before. It's never happened since. But I rushed to my computer and I quickly sketched out an outline of 20 chapters. And I sat back from my computer and said, oh my goodness, I've just been given this idea for a novel in my dream. And the dream was very different. In the dream, it was two women traveling by train through Europe, and the train stops in Paris, and one of the women gets off and goes down into a bathroom that's full of art on the walls. And into the bathroom, peculiarly, comes this ex-lover of hers. And she has to make a decision about whether to stay with the lover or to get back on the train with her friend. And people who have read the book, and if I tell them this dream, they can put together the pieces. You know, Paris became Stockholm because that was the city that I had grown to love. You know, the friend, you know, is obviously this friend that I traveled through Sweden with that summer. The lover is the brother character in the book who was completely fictionalized. But that dream, you know, it started out as something, just a little nugget of an idea, and then this outline that allowed me to write it. And so quickly, this idea of Paris became Stockholm because of the city I knew by heart. And that underground bathroom full of art, I mean, it was clearly, once I put it together, the Stockholm subway stations, you know, the Tunnelbana, which are known as the world's longest art gallery because every station is full of art, just like, you know, blasted onto the walls into these cavernous stations. It was all sort of there for me waiting. I just had to reinterpret it as Sweden.
Now, as a teacher, you taught writing. This is your first novel. So I'm just curious to know, with all the experience you have as a teacher, was there any surprises when you decided to sit down and say, I'm going to write this novel?
Well, I've been writing it for a long time. It was, you know, more than a decade since I had that dream, you know, and the book is just coming out. Like, it came out last year in hard copy and now in paperback. So I was writing and teaching concurrently. But I think the thing that really surprised me was how much freedom I had when I was able to start fictionalizing my grief, like my true, true, true grief that I experienced after the death of my parents. I think there was an early feeling that if I was ever going to write about that, I was going to have to write it as a memoir. But there was always on my shoulder this feeling like almost a self-censorship that would sort of rise up. Like, are you getting this exactly right? You know, like, is this really how that story happened? And when I said I can do this as fiction, then all of my feelings were able to really come into being on the page. And I think that was exciting for me to now share with my students, you know, that you can take this nugget of your life and shapeshift it into fiction, and that truth can still exist there sometimes in a more radiant way.
Well, now that you've written this novel and you're a published author with a novel out, has that in any way, shape, or form changed you as a teacher?
You know, I was 46 when the book came out, right? And I think that's one thing that I'm able to tell my students now, that, you know, your first book can be waiting for you at any age. And so I love teaching adult students. I love teaching people who have had books inside of them their whole lives and have just needed the space, the time, or the teacher to say, hey, you know, look, I had this experience where, you know, it took a little bit longer than I thought it would to get the book out. But when it came out, the timing was perfect. You know, looking back, it wouldn't change anything. And just encouraging them to see that they still have is ahead of them if that's what they really want to achieve.
Do you believe in the old axiom that everyone has a book inside of them?
I think that everyone has lots of stories inside of them. And there's something special in the people who have this glimmer of desire to write, and that desire never goes away their whole lives, even if they've not made space for it. But that idea, that want keeps coming up, I think that is what it takes. Believing in yourself that you could do it someday. For some people, it goes away. For those who are still nurturing that, who still recognize it, it's available to them at any time.
Well, the book is called The All Night Sun. It's written by Diane Zinna. And Diane, I thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program with us. Are you working on a second novel?
I am. This time I'm going to take everyone to Korea with me.
Great. Thanks for being on the program with us.
It was my pleasure. Thank you so much.
Diane Zinna, the author of The All Night Sun. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com to the page for this show, which is show number 0626. And you'll find links to Diane's website and also links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order her book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, a show that's heard on many fine stations, including Gold 90.5 FM in Singapore.
Got something for the mailbag? Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. Send your email to mailbag@thestufffile.com. And remember, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H. That's mailbag@thestufffile.com. Or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Often I mention my book, Great Conversations, my interviews with two men on the moon and a galaxy of stars. I also often mention that I'd like you to become a patron of the Stuff File program via Patreon.com. Well, this is my opportunity to combine both of those pleas to you. You've heard me say on many occasions about the myriad of celebrities I've had the chance to talk to that are contained in my book, which is published by Bear Manor Media. You've also heard me mention that some of the celebrities in my book, and many others, can be heard on our page at Patreon.com. Well, if you've been on the fence about joining Patreon, let me try to pull you over to our side. By becoming a patron, you help to make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. And if you do become a regular patron, as a Patreon reward, I'll share with you an electronic version of my book for your e-reader. So join Patreon and claim your copy of Great Conversations, my interviews with two men on the moon and a galaxy of stars. Sign up today at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram.
You're experiencing The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Sit back, relax, let it rattle around between your ears, tickling your cerebellum, and enjoy.
And still to come in the program, we'll talk to Marty McGibbon, author of Fierce, Funny, and Female. We do have an idiot of the day, but I have a few more Stuff File news stories to share with you here on The Stuff File program. And by the way, portions of the program can now be heard on the new audio service called Audia. That's A-U-D-E-A, a platform that allows you to listen to segments of audio much in the same way that YouTube allows you to watch videos. There you'll get to hear some fresh conversations from the Stump File program, but you'll also get a chance to go back into our archives and hear chats going all the way back to 2009. So check it out. It's Audia. Go to audia.io. That's A-U-D-E-A.io. Let's get back to the stuff. During his two tours of duty in Vietnam, Daniel Laws earned multiple medals, including two Bronze Stars and two Purple Hearts. After his death, his daughter, Erica Laws, placed his medals and ribbons next to his ashes on the family homestead in North Carolina. Someone broke in and stole them. Said Erica, "It just got me right here because you can't replace it. I felt so bad because he protected the country, and I can't even protect his memory." A man contacted the police saying that 31-year-old Charles Carr gave him one of the Purple Hearts in exchange for a bottle of Code Red Mountain Dew. Police have issued a warrant for Carr's arrest on charges of obtaining property by false pretense. Ashes to ashes, dust to dust, metals to soda. Oh, there's a special place in hell for this guy.
And unlike in heaven, he won't enjoy Riding the Lava.
And before we get to this next story, I have a simple question to ask each and every one of you out there. How upset would you be if a total stranger came into your house and started peeing everywhere? Keep that thought in mind as I share this next item. A drunk man was killed by a shark while trying to urinate in the ocean. 51-year-old Marcelo Roca Santos was reportedly drinking with friends at a beach in Brazil when he decided to wade out into the ocean to relieve himself, despite several signs warning people to stay away from the ocean. The surf had become tumultuous, making it hard to see anything in the water. The shark attacked Santos and bit off his hand and a chunk of his leg. Santos's friends dragged him back to the shore, and he was taken to hospital where he was pronounced dead. It's believed that it was either a bull or tiger shark that carried out the attack. And the moral of the story is, don't mark someone else's territory. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here in this edition of the Stuff All program, shall we? Back in 2013, we talked to Marty McGibbon, a stand-up comic who had more tragedy and drama in her life than most people. At the time, she was promoting her book entitled Never Give Into Fear, Laughing All the Way Up from Rock Bottom. Well, since then, she has written a second book. It's called Fierce, Funny, and Female, A Journey Through Middle America, the Texas Oil Field, and Stand-Up Comedy. She has also become a trauma and resilience expert. Marty joins us via Skype from California. Hi, Marty.
Hi, Peter.
Nice to have you back on the program with us again. I urge people to go back and listen to our previous conversation, which was in show number 0181 back in 2013, because I'm not going to rehash all the stuff we talked about then. But you've had a harrowing life leading up to when I last spoke to you, and it's been a little over 8 years since we last chatted. So I'm just curious to know, because, I mean, you had issues, you had drug problems and whatnot. And has everything been fine over the last 8 years? There have been no relapses or anything?
Oh, no, no. And at the time, no, I've had, let's see, August 8th was the August 8th of 1995 is when I turned my life around after nearly 10 years of just severe drug addiction. I mean, hardcore intravenous drug use, just really, and homelessness and, you know, all these things and PTSD, which I didn't know I had, you know, until later. But, you know, when I spoke with you, I had been in recovery since 95, uninterrupted. I'm so grateful that I didn't have the relapses, but now it's coming up on, I guess, 26 years. So my life has been really good. The second half of my life has been fantastic. The first half was interesting, you know, and there was fun in there too, but I had so much tragedy and trauma, and I'm sort of laughing about it now, and I'm not laughing about it because it was because of the tragedy and trauma, but because I'm so happy now. But I had, that's the reason I wrote this second. So when I spoke with you, I'd written the first memoir, and the reason I had written that was because I wanted it to be a darkly humorous cautionary tale, just to let people know that, hey, you don't have to go over the cliff. You know, you don't have to descend into the abyss like I did. You can turn this around. I want to tell you some of the things that happened, you know, so that you can know. And that was kind of, I just thought, if I can reach one person through that book, then I will not have lived in vain, you know, that kind of thing. So I had that book, and it was, it did really well. And it's been read by a lot of people. And I also launched a speaking career. So, you know, I had been a stand-up comic professionally for 10 or more years of professional stand-up clubs and colleges and everything. I became an inspirational speaker. People were asking me to speak at different events. And the reason was because I had come out publicly about some of the stuff that I have lived through. So one of the things, and they all have a lot of stigma attached to them, like addiction and mental health issues, you know, PTSD. And having been, I'm a survivor of human trafficking, as you know. And so, you know, I came out about all of that because I wanted people to know that you can, there's life after. No matter how far down you've gone or no matter how difficult something is, if you've lived through it, you're already a winner. Just the fact that you're still alive. And then anything else that you do is just, you get to decide, okay, what do I want to do with my life now?
You touched on the human trafficking, and I did want to bring up that point once again, only because
yes,
we touched on it back when we chatted the last time. And I think the one thing I did not get a chance to ask you, and maybe it's even more pertinent 8 years later. Your book has been your first book was very successful, award-winning.
Yes.
Were you ever concerned when you were writing it about any repercussions, about putting stuff like that into the book when you had to, you were a subject of human trafficking with a Japanese mob.
And they
tend to hold a grudge.
Yeah. It was terrifying. And I just thought, you know, but I'm going to have to. I just need to do this because it was that terrible trauma that made my addiction so severe and so difficult to break out of. And with many people, you know, I hold 5 professional certifications in addiction treatment, and I've been a counselor with client populations who have a lot of, you know, where there's a lot of trauma and stuff. And so, you know, I know that so many times when someone is severely addicted, there's trauma in there. There are adverse childhood experiences, there may be adult traumatic experiences that can fuel the addiction and complicate it, right? You know, as I was writing, because when I first started writing it, I thought, you know, I don't know, am I gonna I had those concerns. I had a lot of that. But then at the same time, I just thought, you know what, you know, the story needs to be told. And I just took a chance on that. And also, one of the things that I was very afraid of while I was writing it, and I had to face the fear within my own mind, like, what are people going to think? What's going to happen? What are people going to say? What about your organized crime figures and some of those things? Will this be, you know, I had to face that every day while I was writing. There's something about, you know, when you're afraid, you know, I've read this from different writers, you know, who have written about things. They say like the lizard brain, you know, if the lizard is afraid, you know, just keep going, you know, like... If you're afraid, just keep going with it, you know?
Let me ask you this. Your second book, Fierce, Funny, and Female, A Journey Through Middle America, the Texas Oil Field, and Stand-Up Comedy. You consider this book to be a prequel to your first book.
Yes. It's a prequel because it's the stuff in my life that predetermined a creative vulnerability for the trauma as an adult. Right. You know, I had some things happen as a young person, you know, many experiences of sexual abuse and sexual assault from adults, you know, from authority figures, not my parents, not my family. But there was a school teacher and there were some orderlies at a psychiatric ward because I had an incident where I was put in a psychiatric ward. And this was all, you know, 15, 16 years old, 17 years old, these things happening. And then I had some other horrific experiences. I married someone and the marriage, I mean, it was just like, oh. So there was just all this stuff. And then I rebounded from that. I became one of the first women to work in the Texas oil field as a laborer and, you know, was making good money. But, competing with men, not competing, but yeah, I mean, they saw it as competition. But anyway, working in a male-dominated field and a male-dominated field that's kind of scary even for guys to get into, you know, where you got these, there were so many. I was working with all these ex-convicts. And I mean, the other people I was working with were civil engineers, you know, and tech people. But then you also had, you know, going out into the field to set off explosives and stake oil wells. And some of the guys I worked with, were, you know, it was really, you know, some tough stuff, right? But I learned how to handle myself. I learned so much from them. You know, I learned so much from the male. And I think, oh, that's something I'm going to use. You know, like this whole thing of bravado and some of that stuff, you learn how to use it, right? So it was helpful. and funny. I mean, hilariously, some of the stories in Fierce, Funny, and Female are just absolutely hilarious. And the things that happened, Peter, I mean, this was the kind of thing, this was the 1980s, the oil field, and it was like the Wild West, and everybody, you know, like all kind of, not only setting off the explosives, but then there was guys who I worked with, you know, they would go and rob a liquor store on their lunch hour. You know, I mean, really. And some of the crew chiefs would even, you know, take their crew out and do a robbery and then do a hot, you know, be in the police in hot pursuit. And there'd be a big car chase through the.
Well,
things like that happen. I mean, not every day, but I mean, this was the kind of people there. Well, you've had oil field exploration in Canada. There was a lot of boom in Canada,
yeah.
You know, with. So you know what I mean? You get, it's pretty wild.
I guess they come back and say drinks all around.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, let me ask you this, because we're running out of time, but let me ask you this.
Yeah.
With so much trauma and so much heartache and all the things that happened to you in your life,
mm-hmm.
that, as I think I said to you in the last time, could make a plethora of Lifetime movies.
Yeah.
What is it about your resolve, I guess you can say, what is it about you that allowed you to survive all of this when a lesser person wouldn't survive a quarter of what you've been through?
Well, thank you for saying lesser person. I don't know about that. But I have a sense of humor. And I've got my family to thank for that. My parents, both very funny people, always had a lot of sense of, you know, just great sense of humor. I grew up with that. I would go into that mode like, okay, what's funny about it? Is there anything funny about that? I mean, and that does help, but I was able to find meaning. And later, you know, in my mental health education and what I know about that, that's actually a thing that therapists try to help people to do, is to find meaning. So I'm a storyteller, a born storyteller. I've always in my life looked at things as, you know, sort of a story, like telling myself stories, you know, tell yourself a good story, like, okay, you can do this, you know, you're going to come, that kind of thing. And I think that helped me a lot. And then also to be able to, now this, when I was in the trauma, this is where I was vulnerable to more and more trauma, because when you go through a traumatic experience, trauma can make you, it can bring feelings of, you know, to be too self-critical. Right. Or to feel worthless, self-loathing kind of thing. And that is a natural thing that happens. There's a normal response to trauma where your beliefs about yourself, other people in the world, they are just shattered. And that's a normal response to trauma. So I had to build a kind of a belief system and to learn to believe in myself. And I think that's what carried me through, to learn to believe that there would be a tomorrow and that things would keep getting better and that I was going to be able to make it through. And as long as I didn't let, you know, die, you know, kill myself, you know, that it was going to get better.
Well, you are an amazing woman, and I still think you should get Lifetime on the Line. your most recent book is Fierce, Funny, and Female, A Journey Through Middle America, The Texas Oil Field, and Stand-Up Comedy. And Marty, I thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program with us once again.
Thank you, Peter.
Marty McGibbon, author of Fierce, Funny, and Female, A Journey Through Middle America, The Texas Oil Field, and Stand-Up Comedy. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com to this week's show page, which is show number 0626, and you'll find links to her site. And remember, you can also hear Marty's previous appearance from 2013 on show number 0181. It's also on the Audia audio service under the title Marty McGibbon, a comic who's had a tragic life. Again, all of these links will be on the show page for this week's show, including links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order her book directly. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, which is heard everywhere, including World FM in New Zealand, 88.2 FM. And now, boys and girls, it's that moment you've all been waiting for. It's time now for The Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. This Stuff File presents The Idiot of the Day.
This This week, we take you all the way to Down Under. Oh, and before we get to the story, I just had a thought that I wanted to share. When you say the term Down Under, everybody knows what you're talking about, and the folks in Australia have even accepted that as a term of endearment and pride. So those who are in the Flat Earth Society are really dumb, but those who are members of the Flat Earth Society in Australia are just off the charts in more ways than one. Anyway, sorry for going off on a tangent. Let's just get to the idiot of the day. Police say two men involved in stealing trading cards from an Adelaide business then went and tried to sell them back to the store the same day. Police say the group broke into the business and stole a large number of rare Digimon trading cards and board games sometime on Monday night or Tuesday morning. At about 11:15 p.m. the same day, police say a man returned to the same store and tried to sell the allegedly stolen cards. Staff called police and the man led officers to a nearby house where they found cards and games along with two other suspects. At 3 p.m., a separate man went to the same store and also wanted to sell Digimon cards, but he was also arrested by police. In all, five men have all been charged with offenses including serious criminal trespass, unlawful possession, and theft by receiving. Now, why, oh why, would you break into any business overnight and try to sell the items back to the same store later that afternoon? I mean, that's like robbing a bank, then opening an account there to make a deposit. Well, one reason, and one reason only. You're idiots!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program, number 0626. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com. And once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links at all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number. And once again, that's 0626. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as PA Holder. And don't forget to check us out on patreon.com, where you can become a patron of the program. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including the podcast station, CyberStationUSA.com, KDXRadio.com, PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on Apple or Google Podcasts, streaming on Spotify, Stitcher, and iHeartRadio, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, CKUW-FM in Winnipeg, and CFMU in Hamilton. That's it. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. While it may be an enjoyable, pleasant experience, some side effects may occur. Listening to Peter may cause bloating, drowsiness, Tourette's, web feet, or an oily discharge.